I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from West Asia, where the war from Yemen to Lebanon to Syria to Iraq to Gaza has been widened, with US puppet Zelensky voicing support for the genocide in Gaza. The war is arguably wider still. One of the most important daily worldwide broadcasts that evades NATO censorship is Redacted, a bastion of independent journalism that refuses to lay down and believe press releases from Blinken's State Department or alleged genocide co-conspirator Joe Biden. Natalie Morris, former MSNBC anchor, co-hosts the show with her husband, former Fox News host Clayton Morris, who beat Tucker Carlson to leaving the Murdoch mainstream outlet. Natalie joins me now from Lisbon, Portugal.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Natalie, for coming on. So let's just kick off your view of how the retaliation from Iran has been covered in US media, the media landscape you inhabited before starting Redacted.
Yeah. You know, it's confounding. Of course, we all see that. But what's confounding me the most is how the United States continues to spin whether or not Israel not having civilian losses in Iran's retaliation just several days ago. Let's see that as a win and de-escalate. It seems as though the United States has its puppets off their leash. These puppies are off the leash. They're not in control any longer. So the spin, it just doesn't make any sense anymore, unless you're only just joining the conversation right now, because the last 2 years have shown that the United States doesn't get their way. They spin things in a way that doesn't make any sense at all. Like you mentioned in your introduction, that Zelensky now expressing support for the genocide in Gaza. What does he care? He supported a genocide in the Donbas for the whole of his presidency. So clearly that doesn't bother him, taking the champion that was Zelensky and now resigning him to second seat. It's just clear that foreign policy in the United States is inconsistent and it has nothing to do with respect for life.
And night after night, you cover conflicts, but it's as if conflicts are only successful from the viewpoint of NATO nations, if they kill lots of people.
I suppose so, but I don't think that even NATO leaders believe what they're saying, because they continue to move the goalpost. We see them doing that in Ukraine, where 2 years ago, it just was very fashionable to support Ukraine, give Ukraine whatever you wanted. As you mentioned, I live in Western Europe, and when the conflict came out, it was all over the place how fashionable it was to save Ukrainians. Whatever you can do, take in a Ukrainian refugee. I donated a car seat and some extra antibiotics. I don't know where the heck those things went. It was just all the WhatsApp mom groups. What can we do? We're so heroic because we're saving Ukraine. Well, just a few days ago, Zelensky signed into law the most draconian draft law we've seen in modern history, the conscription of even people who are no longer physically fit. He will be dragging them back into medical exams to see if they are, in fact, someone that just a warm body they can put on the front lines to serve. The fact that they'll be asking paper. I mean, in the United States, we had a fit over the papers, please law in Arizona. We apparently don't mind that it will be happening in Ukraine. So, you know, this idea that Ukraine is a democracy worth saving, that we need to continue to go into debt for and support so that other people die, but we don't have to. Well, it's a joke. And you can see that NATO, they don't believe it. They're just saying it because their paymasters require it.
Yeah, Zelensky signing up teenagers. Of course, he abolished elections. But then when you see how, I mean, I've got to say personally, when I was in London before coming out here, it was clear people were supporting Ukraine because they were told to do so then. And how are you finding the pivoting that even New York Times and Washington Post and those mouthpieces already trying to soften up public opinion, but at the same time, Biden continuing to say Ukraine is as important as ever, with a few nuanced backtracking elements?
Right. I was shocked to see David Cameron dusted off for this very purpose, to do a tour in the United States to sell the idea of continuing to support Ukraine.
You think that's why he went to see Trump in Mar-a-Lago?
Possibly. Possibly. And, you know, of course, I'd be disappointed with any leader who continues to support war in Ukraine, because not just because of what it does to the American budget and my taxes. We just, you know, a few days ago had our tax day, and boy, that felt like a kick in the pants, because I know as we're paying our taxes as Americans, well, here's a HIMAR that will do nothing to achieve any goals other than just continuing to kill innocent civilians in Ukraine. And I think that you're right about the idea of, yeah, I was in London recently too, and I saw Ukrainian flags up in people's windows, and I still see them on social media profiles. And whenever I see that, I just think, you literally have done no research on this. You're just doing what the BBC wants you to do. It's shocking. And I feel like, okay, either I'm going to engage with that person and we're going to talk about, you know, the history of Ukraine, at least starting back as 2012, or we're not. We're just not going to have conversations about it, because anyone who actually studied, you know, there's a great academic that I've been reading all of his books since about 2010 called Gilbert Doctorow. And he'd been warning about this and publishing books. He's an American academic talking about how Russia is warning us that we are provoking them, not just with NATO expansion, but by moving into Ukraine and Ukraine torturing the people of the Donbas that they're fighting so hard to get back. I think most people just don't know that. They just refuse to study. But another book that I had read, oh, about 2 or 3 years ago, called Borderlands, and this is a very pro-Ukrainian book. It was a woman who just had Ukrainian ties and wanted to write a book about Ukraine's recent history. And she had said that the leadership in Ukraine, one of the things they were the most afraid of is losing the Donbas region, because it's so wealthy in resources, the mines there for uranium and other things. Well, that's exactly what happened. So they'd been furiously worried about keeping this region while also torturing these people. And I think just, yeah, you're right. The New York Times has been reluctant to cover that.
The author, Anna Reid, they're very clear in her support for the war. But then how easy will it be to filter down to the public? You saw those Ukrainian flags still there. They're not using the word unprovoked as often, maybe. And now we have a leak regarding the other NATO nation-backed war in Gaza. New York Times apparently sending a memo to staff saying, stop using the word genocide, occupied territory, don't use the word Palestine. I mean, for a start, it's that clear from editorial. Was it your experience when you were working in so-called mainstream media that you'd get these memos telling you not to use certain words? And how easily will the publics be persuaded to change their views, say, with regard to Ukraine, and continue to support genocide as with Gaza?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think that the mainstream media is ever going to admit that they were wrong on Ukraine, that they were swallowing a line, that basically support for war in Ukraine was tantamount to believing weapons of mass destruction. And I don't think they're going to do that. I don't know if you saw the recent article in the Free Press by the NPR news editor, Yuri Berliner was his name, where he talked about how he always knew that NPR, which I think we can extrapolate this to any, maybe once.
It's like the BBC in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah. So if, you know, any maybe once well-respected media outlet like the New York Times or CBS News, but this NPR news editor, what he said was, I always knew NPR was left-leaning, you know, Subaru driving, white educated Democrats, but we always had at least a fair distribution of our audience. But it's shrunk so much and has become so much an echo chamber, for just basically unithought. White liberals, that it's shrunk their audience because of it, because their editorial staff has dug their heels in on certain coverage, such as around Palestine, around COVID, around Hunter Biden's laptop. He goes point by point around George Floyd's death, He said these were opportunities to do real journalism, and NPR decided not to, but instead they held all these diversity meetings. They started tracking their sources based on diversity. So you're not even trying to tell the news. You're only trying to paint a story of virtue signaling. And it, he says, it just eroded right out from under me. What he did was he went to his bosses and said, this is a problem. We have no Republicans working in the news room, so we have no diversity of thought. Nobody is actually trying to see the side of the audience that's leaving us. And the CEO said, oh yeah, it's interesting, I'll take your meeting, and then canceled it and never rescheduled, because he just felt like, I guess for whatever reason, I don't need to hear that. And that's very much my experience, because I never saw this kind of refusal to look at stories when I was a journalist. I was as shocked as everybody else. I was already independent by the time the pandemic hit, but this lack of curiosity about where COVID came from, whether the vaccines were safe or not, whether people were actually being harmed by them, whether the COVID numbers, they lacked curiosity and were all in on punishing people who were curious. And that for me was a big turning point. It's not about pushing the narrative. It's about asking the questions, even if you don't want to. That, and then the war in Ukraine, where you see they're lying. They're just lying. They're pretending like Ukraine just popped up out of the blue like a weed.
In fairness, there was money to be made
for myself.
There was money to be made for commercial stations funded by pharmaceutical companies, in fairness, to the COVID story. There's no money to be made, I suppose, arms stocks, defense stocks. The popularity of shows like Redacted is testament to the fact that people aren't interested in watching all those kind of fake news stories in so-called mainstream media. But then I understand, we've been hit similarly. The Silicon Valley industrial complex has a way of trying to destroy your audience accessing your show.
Yes, they do. I'm sure you're familiar with the CAS review, which is the NHS story. The NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, launched a years-long study showing how little research they have around transgender children, and specifically the sex change surgeries and the cross-sex hormones that they give them at very young ages. And the CAS review was fantastic. I spent a whole weekend reading it.
That's why I didn't get any coverage on Comcast Sky News in Britain, arguably.
Right.
Clearly.
Yes, yeah. And my piece on it, on Redacted, was hit with, they at least downranked it. And so I was really disappointed, because this is an academic paper, but it is me covering it and validating it makes me guilty of wrongthink. And this kind of thing happens to us all the time, and it's really discouraging. And there are times when we're like, why do we do this? You know, it's really terrifying to speak freely on these platforms. But I guess anything that's easy, well, everyone would do it, right? So someone's got to do something hard, and I'm still alive. So that's why we do it. And we have three kids, and I don't want to look at them and think, well, we didn't try our best or try and create the world that you deserve. So yeah, I do want to make that point, though. You mentioned about the New York Times not saying Palestine. I don't use that either, just because those people have not been given a country yet. It's not really a place. And
being recognized by some people.
Did.
But Natalie Morris, I'll stop you there. Yeah. More from the former MSNBC anchor and current co-host of the news talk show Redacted after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Redacted's Natalie Morris.
Thank you for having me.
Natalie, you were talking about the fact that you're still alive in the context of censorship. But, you know, it's an ongoing story, this reauthorization of FISA, warrantless wiretapping. I don't suppose you're going to tell me all about the fact that you and your husband are both bugged by U.S. authorities. But it passed the House, awaiting Senate approval. Edward Snowden tweeting from Moscow, where he has to go for safety. How scary is the reauthorization of this warrantless wiretapping? Or does it not matter? Does do journalists realize in the US they're under surveillance by the security state all the time?
Well, I sort of assume that we're always being watched because of that. I did read Edward Snowden's book and I found it terrifying, but I don't think that this is the make or break moment of censorship. I think that this is showing just how complicit our leaders are by allowing it. But even if it had not passed, even if there was no supporters of it, you know that these government agencies are still going to continue to casually dip into whatever they want and help themselves to whatever bits of your life that they want. And so I think that it's more insidious than that, than just this one bill. And I think it's going to take much more of an overhaul than just, you know, one bill. One of the things that I think is so interesting is that these different government agencies now, they just keep popping up and being born. CISA, the CISA, is a new one from the State Department that terrifies me. And the way that they're using these different non-government agencies to do the bidding of downranking or punishing people on social media or reaching into social media and taking what they'd like. And one of the things that we know is that these agencies don't necessarily talk to each other. So the NSA might buy some data with our tax dollars, I might add. It's April, that's top of mind. So the NSA might buy some data. And then, oh, you know, the CIA is buying that same data, but they actually don't know. The same thing happens with these zero-day exploits, these software bugs that they can get in and watch you however they want. And so it's redundancy. So you see on Redacted, we always have this national debt clock. Well, that is happening for so many reasons, but made worse by the fact that these different government agencies are buying the same digital assets in duplicate, and they just don't know. So even if one agency were told, hey, you kind of got to stop that, or at least you have to start getting a warrant, that doesn't mean the others wouldn't. It's bigger than all that, unfortunately.
Maybe it's because the infrastructure is already paid for in the United States. They don't need the money for it. But you presumably miss the United States, even though from afar you can tell just by statistics about the levels of poverty, inequality, and infrastructural spending. I know that you have on Redacted a different view of what happened with that bridge catastrophe recently in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's still so many things to be learned about that, but it does seem like it's very much a subterfuge. That's something that Clayton's been covering, my husband, at length. But it also just feels like a crumbling, and, you know, it feels, even if it's not a cyber attack, it does feel symbolic of a lot of crumbling infrastructure in the United States, which makes me sad.
I mean, clearly it was dangerous to talk out against COVID because authorities said, oh, it was about lockdowns and so on. How dangerous did you both feel and your team feel when you were questioning the narrative about headless babies, beheaded babies on October the 7th and claims of mass rape and so on October the 7th, which, you know, we've had guests on saying that this was used to justify what mm-hmm. you had redacted, and we on Going Underground call a genocide powered by US, UK, EU nation weaponry.
I will say Israel is the scariest. It's much scarier than Ukraine was. And we felt terrified covering Ukraine for a long time, and we got on some scary lists from people who were very pro-Ukraine, who said that we were traitors or Russian stooges. We had that a lot. Putin apologists.
Now you've joined Hamas. You joined Hamas,
right?
Now, clearly.
Yes. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm trying to think, was I as scared covering all of this in Ukraine over the last 2 years as I have felt about going up against a Zionist government? And I don't know. I'm scared a lot. So I'm not sure, you know, if
I think you had Gonzalo Lira on your show.
We did. Yeah.
Might have to remind us what happened to him.
Right. Yeah. Someone who was not protected by the United States government was thrown in jail and died there from neglect, apparently. And it's a much different story than Alexei Navalny, who splashed all over the headlines comically at the Oscars. Actually, the night that Navalny died, I was in Dubai. And I couldn't take it watching all of the coverage of people lauding him as a hero. And I thought, you don't know. You're not studied. So it was one of my more successful pieces that I sat down in our hotel room and I told the story of all of the things that we're not told about Navalny. And yet he still showed up on glossy magazine covers after his death. And Biden decided to do a press conference, a live press conference, which he never does. So yes, that, I don't know, maybe I'm just, because it's been a long time of being labeled a Putin apologist, it doesn't bother me as much, but I definitely, watching what happened to Candace Owens, watching the great coverage of Ian Carroll, I'm afraid of, you know, covering Israel in this way. It seems a little bit more insidious, but, you know, we're just here to ask the questions. And, you know, one of the things that we say on our show is we are unapologetically pro-peace and anti-war. And you will never, ever convince me that a bomb is the answer to anything. And so if that comes off as anti-Semitic, I really, you know, don't care. Because I think that what the Zionist government is doing is hurting the Jewish population more than anything else. And I'm terrified to see, you know, how this continues to escalate. But, you know, I would love to have seen a peaceful solution. I would love for Palestine to be a place that has a flag and a government and an airport and all of the things that those people deserve. I would have loved to have seen that in 1948, but that's not the world we have right now. So our main agenda is peace. And a lot of times the narrative exploited to get you to cheer for war. And I will refuse anytime, no matter how terrible the reality is, I'm never going to say, well, then, yeah, you got to kill that person. Sorry. I just won't. And a lot of the, because I have one of my closest friends, very, you know, pro-Zionist state. And I said, you know, any of this retaliation, it brings retaliation on us. And that's the thing, that you can't stop that cycle until somebody does. And I don't accept it if someone wants to come to me and say, oh, Putin apologist or anti-Semite. It feels like they're not engaging on the actual discussion of peace. They're just throwing bombs and then running out of the room. And so, I say to my kids sometimes when someone throws these like nasty labels at me and then runs away and doesn't engage on the issue, it's like when the dog pees on the floor, like you can't deal with it. You just clean it up and walk away, you know?
I mean, Gonzalo Lira, of course, American journalist who found dead in a Ukrainian prison, and Navalny, I suppose you were in Dubai and, you know, part of what you wrote after Navalny's death in Russia, he said some pretty ferocious things against Islam, and Dubai, of course, the UAE, a Muslim country. So perhaps slightly more muted the weeping for this Islamophobe nationalist Navalny in this region. Do you think that providing context then is always going to have you be accused with these slurs? In fairness, the anti-Semite tag doesn't seem to be working as well for the Zionist lobby in the United States. We've seen big demonstrations coast to coast in the United States, let alone in Western Europe.
I would hope so, sure. But that's, I feel like that's my place in this world because I'm a bit of a Poindexter. I like to just read long volumes of back history to figure out what's going on. And context is the only way we can make sense of this world. And so, yeah, I think that I'm thrilled that there's an audience for that, for people who are Poindexters like me, and they want to just read and understand, and they realize we're being not told the whole truth, and they'll come along for the ride. And, you know, that doesn't mean I'm always, you know, I try to think of where I'm guided next, what to read next as...
Yeah, it's so like wide-ranging, you know, because, you know, fans of Redacted will notice that both of you have different views sometimes. World War III, arguably underway now, means while so-called mainstream media is rejoicing over all new weaponry that's going to be used to wipe people out, even on Redacted, you can sense when you're watching it, you do want to cover, you know, healthcare, food, big pharma, all sorts of different subjects. Is it kind of edging out all those issues that interest you? I mean, you mentioned transgender issues in part one. Does it annoy you that you can't talk about the issues that perhaps everyday people, working classes of Western Europe and the United States, can't as much because the very existence of all people in Western Europe is now under threat?
Yes, a lot. I don't want to have a big audience because everybody's worried about war. Because if there wasn't a war that would keep people tuning into the news, then we would just have to do better. We'd have to be more interesting. We'd have to, you know, we could cover the things that we might be, we might find interesting more, right? But right now there's war. And so, definitely. I would love it if we were in peacetime and we all could continue to innovate and make the, you know, world the way we want it, but that's not what we've got right now. And it doesn't seem like we have leaders who are even interested in that at all. And especially in Europe, in fact, I think I had this idea of moving to Europe as this utopia. And I'm sad at the Europe that I find, because at least in the United States,
I had to leave Europe, you know, arguably. And Julian Assange, of course, famously is in Europe shortly, perhaps to go to the United States. Just finally, I mean, do you think we'll ever see Redacted on so-called mainstream television when this bad nightmare is of so-called journalists refusing to question the news ends?
No, and I don't aspire to that, really.
So that more people can watch journalism that questions things rather than journalism that just writes down what they're told in press releases.
Perhaps, but I don't know if the television is that place. I think as media morphs and people watch
Your friends are Tucker Carlson, of course, who abandoned TV.
Yes. Yeah, he's a good friend of Clayton's and a family friend. And yeah, I used to care a lot about that because it was more of like what we all collectively understood or what my parents understood better. But now I feel like we have a larger reach than I ever did when I was on cable news. And so it doesn't feel like the fish that got away. It feels like we flowed with the times. But I will say, it's so nice that you invited me to talk about our show and the trajectory of my career, because none of the legacy mainstream media is interested in saying like, oh, this girl was one of us. What's she doing? How'd she arrive here? What's this about? Crickets, right? And I used to get all kinds of invitations when I was a member of them to do someone else's podcast, this magazine, this, you know, little thing I was once in Maxim as like women we list, like none of that. No one's interested in this independent voice because it's against the grain. So you are, and I appreciate that very much. I put on makeup to come on your show. So I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, Natalie Morris. And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to the survivors of US-UK EU nation armed killing in Palestine, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, Iran, and Iraq. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.